download that you had before.
Yeah.
This is okay.
Yeah, we got okay. Chapter 1, Part 1, June 1923, hyperinflation.
Under a private central bank.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
So, here are some pictures. I don't know how people lived with the currency like that.
Yep. Oh. They probably did.
I mean, they're using it as waste paper. They're using it to light a stove. And they're sweeping it up in the streets. I mean, you would think at a certain point, the society, the bank would just stop printing it.
Yeah. But they didn't do that?
No, they just printed it so to oblivion. So what did people, I mean, how did people buy anything in the cities?
My understanding is you spent the money as soon as you got it before it devalued even further.
Yeah. But at this point, they're not even doing that. They're just...
Well, they're probably old banknotes from last week that are now worth a billionth of a mark or something.
A billionth of a mark.
Wow. Incredible. Anne, could you read the themes?
Themes of Lost Science of Money book. 1, primary importance of the money power, power to create money and relegate it. 2, nature of money purposely kept secret and confused. 3, how a society defines money determines who controls the society. 4, battle over control of money has raged for millennia, public versus private. 5, the misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for the ordinary people. That's Will Decker and Martin Dunn, February 2014.
I know them.
6, whenever the public has owned a significant fraction of the money power, great public benefit has ensued. Sparta, the Roman Republic, the American colonies in the 18th century, greenbacks after the Civil War, Canada after the Great Depression, British experience after World War II. That's from Martin Dunn, July 2014.
And that's a good observation. Very, very important observation.
Yeah.
So here are the parts of the presentation. There's the introduction, and then we're going to talk about an emerging Germany. This is in the 20th century, the Baghdad Railway.
Yeah, the Baghdad Railway. I was been reading about.
And then an author, Zimmern, Z-I-M-M-E-R-N, Zimmern, he wrote The Economic Weapon, talking about the economics of Germany in the World War I. Then the Treaty of Versailles, 1919. Then Germany's 1923 hyperinflation by a private central bank, and how is a currency destroyed? Too many German marks are issued. The cause of the inflation, shock tells the truth, finally. Stabilizing the monetary situation, a currency called the Rentenmark. And then Schack in charge, the government stabilizes the currency. Then we're going to talk about who was Hjalmar Schacht, and then continuing on with the reparations of the war, we'll talk about the Dawes Plan and the foreign loans used carefully. And this will take us all the way up to basically 1930 and the stock market crash. Okay. So Will, why don't you do the first slide?
Okay, it's the introduction of private money attacks government. The German hyperinflation is used to promote the idea that only private bankers can be trusted to control the society's money system. When the monetary facts are actually examined, it becomes clear that these private banking elements were deeply involved in the speculation that helped to bring down the Reichsmark. This was not stopped until the government repeatedly took divisive action against them. Zarlingo, Law, Science of Money, page 575. Private banks.
Right. This, of course, is never mentioned by economists. It's only used to show how governments should not be given the money power, because they'll just really abuse it, you know. So this is what Stephen's trying to show in this chapter.
The opposite is true.
The opposite, yes. Opposite. Martin, do the next one. Do the next couple.
Okay, we've got a map of the German Confederation there. The emerging Germany, Baghdad Railway. Germany centralized late in Europe. By 1815, Germany had the German Federation, which wasn't yet an integral state. Can we go to the next slide?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. We have a picture.
Baghdad Railway.
Presumably the Baghdad Railway. There's the recommended route, which actually goes from London all the way to Istanbul. Alternative via Brussels and Cologne, and an alternative via Belgrade goes up to Budapest.
Belgrade.
So that's the Orient Express we're looking at there, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the Orient Express. Okay, the Orient Express already connected Germany to Istanbul in 1883 plus. Mm. Okay, and up there on the right, we have a picture of what looks like a ceremonial British summer.
Yeah.
Time to see outside Buckingham Palace. With what looks like a Turkish guy, and that looks like the mosque in Istanbul.
Right. So you could go from London all the way to Istanbul on this very, very wealthy train. It was really for very high society. Or you could go from Paris or Brussels all the way, but you would be going through the German Federation.
This led to changes in the Middle East.
Okay, honey. So
you're on camera.
Oh.
That's my son. I didn't know the camera was on. Yeah, very interesting, this train. So already Germany was connected to Istanbul at the end of the 19th century, right?
1883.
I'll do the next one. The Baghdad Railway, begun in 1903 by the outbreak of World War I, the Berlin Baghdad Railway was still 600 miles away from its intended objective.
Yeah.
This Berlin Baghdad Railway was financed by Deutsche Bank.
Bank. I guess that's what I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that it had joined the Orient Express.
Yeah, it was different. Different railroad. Right from Berlin.
Well, it's different from it's because it started in Berlin, but it didn't join the Orient Express. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're helping straighten me out.
And I guess the dotted lines in Persia, Turkey and Persia, are the ones that hadn't been completed by the beginning of World War I. See that? Yeah. You see the dotted lines?
Yeah.
Yeah. So supposedly this was causing distress to the British, because there was competition to Britain's naval power. right? They could, that they could go right through the land to the oil land.
Yeah. So they sent Lawrence to blow it up.
Sure. When was Lawrence of Arabia?
Before what?
Before or after?
During World War
One. During World War One.
Oh.
Yeah. What a movie. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Anne, do the next one.
Cimmern's the economic weapon, economic siege. A.E. Cimmern was identified by Professor Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, as part of the Anglo-American establishment. I guess in her book, Tragedy and Hope. Cimmern, okay. So, and there we see the cover of the book.
Right.
Okay.
It's called The Economic Weapon.
Oh.
It's called The Economic Siege.
Siege.
I guess. Yeah. Yes.
So what is the economic situation?
This is from the book.
Oh, that's from the book. Okay. It can be stated in a sentence. The Central Powers are being besieged by practically the entire world, and they have no means at their disposal for bringing the siege to an end. And that's from Cimmern, The Economic Weapon. Okay. All right, so...
When did he write that?
1918.
Okay, because the unrestricted submarine warfare was a real way for the Germans to actually starve out, particularly the British.
Yeah.
I'm not getting what we're reading here.
Okay, so look at the map. The
Central Powers.
The Central Powers are in orange.
Yeah.
So it looks like there's four of them, I can tell.
Yeah.
Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire. The opposite side, the Allies, are all everything in yellow.
Yeah.
I think it's like the whole world around them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few neutral nations. Switzerland, Netherlands, and Spain.
And it says they're being besieged, but was that by the war?
The entire world.
Yeah, but was that the war, World War One? I mean, who? Yes. How are they being besieged?
Yes.
Okay, because that's
this
not
is in
clear.
World War One.
Yeah. Okay. It's not,
okay.
Hasn't been stated. Yeah.
And they have no means at their disposal for bringing the siege to an end.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, Martin, what was your comment about the submarine warfare?
Well, Germany went for unrestricted submarine warfare. To sink Allied shipping, particularly British shipping. The idea was to starve Britain out. In other words, to economically blockade by unrestricted submarine warfare the Allied powers, particularly Britain. So they actually tried to do something similar in submarine.
Fine.
All fighting for that oil today.
Nice.
Okay. Zimmerman's the economic weapon. The name of it is the economic siege. Okay. All right. Zimmerman concerning the World War One and the peace. And I think we've got a quote from him. That must be a quote.
Yes.
But without raw materials, there can be no industrial employment. And demobilization. Without employment, ready to hand for the disabled soldiers.
Disbanded.
Disbanded soldiers spells social disaster.
Disorder.
It's going to be social disaster. I like my word better than this. The whole civilized world will be faced with the prospect of a shortage, if not a famine. Some will have to go short. Who more naturally than Germany? Okay? It will come almost of itself unless special provision is made in the peace. So we're going to let them go to disaster.
Absolutely.
Okay, and you got a picture of the New York Journal. Germany gives up war, ends at 2 p.m. He ceases. And then we got World War I, all of the disaster. It looks like a painting, but I guess that's a photograph.
Photograph, yeah.
Looks like Oklahoma after one of our tornadoes.
Right.
Wow. Look at that.
Yeah, we look like that.
Yes, that's true.
What kind of weapons did they have in World War I that did that kind of devastation?
Artillery. Yeah.
Oh my God. Martin.
Krupp made the cannons. And I guess, I wonder who our cannon makers were.
Incredible.
Addison's World War I, the treaty was signed in 1919. That was signed on June the 28th, 1919. Germany had to accept blame for starting the war. It also had to pay 1.7 billion marks a year in foreign exchange for 59 years until 1933.
Oh, that's not 33. That should be 83.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, 59 years. That's 60 years.
Okay.
This is the kind of thing that Greece is being asked to do today.
Yeah.
What are they being asked to do, Martin?
Pay back their debts, huge sums of money forever and ever and ever.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God.
They borrowed money under duress, and now they're having to pay it back. Loans made under duress are illegal.
That's right.
Okay. These are territories, I believe, that went to different countries. Alsace-Lorraine went to France. Uthern and Malmedy went to Belgium. North Schleswig, Denmark. Gulshin, I don't know how to pronounce that, Czechoslovakia. West Prussia, Posen, Upper Silesia to Poland. Tsar, Danzig, and Memel to the United Nations. All gains from the Treaty of Brest and Litovsk with Russia. All colonies to the League of Nations. And it was to cut its army to 100,000 men, only have 6 battleships. No submarines or air force, and it was to demilitarize the Rhineland, Germany's industrial armor.
Do you think Germany should be blamed for the war?
Oh, this is interesting. I've got an answer. Should Germany be blamed for the war? Which one are you talking about? World War II now?
No, one. One.
Okay.
Both had responsibility.
It's true. Well, Sue is going to show us.
And this is the one where they cut out the Japanese. The Japanese are sitting there, and the whole thing was conducted like they weren't there.
Oh, really? World War One?
Well, they had defeated Russia. They were fighting Russia. So they were involved in it in that way. Am I saying that right, guys? Japan at the Treaty of Versailles?
Yeah, that's right.
We had a class in which something was mentioned about how they were very resentful after all they had done to resolve the war and defeat Germany, that they were just treated like they weren't there.
So Japan was one of the allies?
Yes, it was actually Japan had been a long ally of Great Britain up to and through World War One.
But then Russia was also an ally of Great Britain, and Japan had warred with Russia.
Yes, they had, but they're still bad blood today.
Wow.
Yeah, you're right about that. As I recall, it was particularly Australia that pushed the issue about Japan, particularly.
Interesting. I'll do the next one. The Treaty of Versailles, 1919. Lord Lothian, another member of the Anglo-American establishment, was the co-author of the Treaty of Versailles, and it would not provide for just peace. That's what Stephen said. American experts actually resigned in protest to its provisions. They protested it. And do the next one.
The Treaty of Versailles. Okay, Francesco Nitti, the Prime Minister of Italy, wrote, quote, "It will remain forever a terrible precedent in modern history that, against all pledges, all precedents, and all traditions, the representatives of Germany were never even heard. Nothing was left to them but to sign the treaty at a moment when famine and exhaustion and threat of revolution made it impossible not to sign. In the old canon law of the church, it was laid down that everyone must have a hearing, even the devil. The new society of nations did not even obey the precepts which the dark Middle Ages held sacred on behalf of the accused." So that's Francesco Nitti, The Wreck of Europe, as quoted by Francis Nielsen, The Makes of War, 1950, page 151.
Must be The Makers of War.
Oh, The Makes of War.
I think that's one of my typos.
Okay. What kind of treaty did the Germans get? When the Allies assembled at Versailles in 1919 to draw up the treaty, it soon became clear that the Germans were not going to get what they hoped for. And under the photo, we see big three, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Roosevelt. And then we see a little unlimited indemnity. Perhaps it would gee up better if we let it touch Earth.
Yeah.
How...
They also applied that principle of unconditional surrender during World War II.
Yes.
The Axis powers were supposed to surrender unconditionally, like with the Treaty of Versailles.
But were there negotiations after World War II with them at the table, or were they? It was just presented. But that was very different. They had the Marshall Plan. They were...
Instead of punishing Germany, they provide... Well, I don't know what the... They did provide the Marshall Plan to rebuild it, so there was no punishment involved at all. Am I right? And...
Not in the sense of the Treaty of Versailles, no.
No. And with Japan, I mean, the emperor went ahead and let us bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki and still wouldn't surrender. But that was actually, I read that was because he was a god. And a god cannot unconditionally surrender and step down and go away. It's just not possible.
So
Roosevelt and company were approaching the emperor in totally the wrong way. The way to do it, and what eventually worked, was they told the emperor, you don't have to step down, you can continue as emperor of Japan, but you have to let, MacArthur, and his troops occupy Japan and then oversee the rebuilding of your country, and we need you to recall all your soldiers back to Japan. If the emperor hadn't done that, if he hadn't still been on the throne and told everybody, okay, we lost, come on home, they would all still be out there in the jungles hiding from us. We would have had a really big mop-up operation to go to China, the Philippines, all those places, and try to find and defeat the Japanese soldiers that were left out there.
Yeah, the majority of the Japanese army was in China.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, the difference in what happened after each of the world wars, because they treated Germany after World War I in such a way that Germany didn't have the wherewithal to pay back its debts, right? They had all its debts now from the war. But after World War II, they treated Europe and Asia, let's help them so that they can pay back. And I just had the thought, I haven't studied this, but I wonder, because after World War II, they knew how they could go into a country like Japan and set up and control the banking system. So they knew they could control the country.
Yeah.
You know. I don't think they really did that after World War I with Germany.
I've never heard of it.
No. Yeah.
Well, you had the three main allies that took over Germany, so it was a triumvirate there, dividing and
ruling
with the Russians.
And they split it into East and West after World War II.
Yeah.
And the West was the one who was returning all the money, creating all the money and paying the debts.
But in Japan, they, after World War II, they kept the warlike banking system where the government decided where resources were going to be put. And this is what the bankers eventually didn't like and did away with that system and put them in jail and killed them and executed them. Am I recalling that right?
That's from Richard Werner's Princes of the End.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
But early on, right after the war, when Japan was invaded by the U.S., you know, occupied, the U.S. was in charge of who was in charge of that Bank of Japan.
Yeah, and they kept their warlike banking system.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Until it was more convenient to get rid of it.
Which is a lot like we'll have under the NEED Act.
Yes.
Deciding where resources will be.
Yes. But it'll be debt-free money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It won't be credit.
Yeah.
Okay. Who did that? Who read
me?
Oh, Ann?
Oh.
Okay, Will.
Yeah. Okay. Five, Germany's 1923 hyperinflation by a private central bank. The First World War seriously damaged but didn't destroy Germany's money system. That came under the occupying forces. Okay? That's employees at Oppenheimer textile business, you got a picture of them, in 1913. And then a German demobilizing.
Nobody.
A big demobilized Jekyll factory in 1919. Yeah. Nobody there.
Yeah.
Nobody. So you have two columns in a chart. Okay. December 1914 and November the 7th, 1918. Germany's money supply in 1914 was 7.2 billion marks. And on November the 7th, 1918, it was 28.4 billion marks.
That's Armistice Day, right? November 7th? Isn't that when the war ended?
I think
that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
It's November
yeah.
the 7th.
Okay.
11. Actually, it was 11-11 or something. 11th hour, 11th day. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now you have, it's 1913 and late 1918. The index of wholesale prices in 1913 would be set at 100, but in 1918, late 1918, 234. and the index of workmen's wages set at 100 in 1913 was 248 in 1918.
Which meant that your average German didn't do badly.
Right.
German what?
Didn't do badly.
Yes.
The wages went up according to the wholesale prices. See? The index is pretty much the same.
Right, so there was a lot more money around, but also you were making more money to buy those inflated commodities.
Yeah.
So it wasn't terrible, it wasn't breaking down terribly.
But things must have gone bad.
After the war, right? Martin, do the next one.
Okay, again, Germany's hyperinflation. This hyperinflation is used to blame governments, implying that government were responsible for the actions of the central bank. But the central bank, by 1922 to 23, was controlled by private bankers. And over there on the left, we have the Reichsbank, the central bank, 1924. And from Stephen Zelenga, Lost Science of Money, page 579 to 580, says, the foreign experts delegated by the League of Nations to guide the economic recovery of Germany wanted a more free market orientation for the German central bank. And this is from, how do you pronounce his first name there?
I would pronounce it Hjalmar.
I would say Hjalmar.
Yeah. Hjalmar.
Hjalmar Schacht.
Hjalmar.
Hjalmar Schacht. Is the T pronounced or not?
I think so. Schacht.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's Hjalmar Schacht. Stabilization of the mark, written in 1927, pages 46 to 51. On May 26, 1922, the law establishing the independence of the Reichsbank and withdrawing from the Chancellor of the Reich any influence on the conduct of the bank's business was promulgated.
So the state
no longer had any influence on the central bank.
We gave the bankers freedom.
Yep, May 1922.
What was it? There was in 2008 or somewhere around that, there was an Indian central banker who said if bankers can't sin, they will.
What did he say?
If they can sin, they will.
Oh.
If bankers can sin.
Yeah. That's a very interesting quote.
Yes.
From a banker, right?
An Indian central banker.
Well,
central bank of India. He kept a very tight rein on the private banks of India.
He's a honest man. I want to write that down. What did you say again? If a banker can...
If bankers can sin, they will.
Okay.
I'll send you an email about it, because I can find which Indian central banker it was who said that.
That'd be great.
There was another quote, and it was from Bertrand Russell, who said, humankind will never refrain from doing that of which it finds itself capable.
Wow. That's interesting.
If they think it can be done, they'll do it. They'll try it.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that's a different meaning. This is similar.
Right, but it's part of the human...
Hey, look, there's an opportunity there to do something bad. Oh, let's do it.
Well, I don't think people think it's bad. They just think, oh, I want that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If they have any moral feelings, they might say, but it's going to hurt people.
No, they won't do that.
No.
No, they might say, but I might get caught. And then they say, nah.
Wow. Okay, so May of 1922, the Reichsbank was private. Private policy. I'll do the next one. How is a currency destroyed? Answer. By issuing not just too much, but far too much of the currency. So we have on the left the British ships in New York Harbor counterfeiting colonial continental currency. Economic war. Then in the center, the British in London counterfeiting the French revolutionary currency called the assignats, economic war. And then what was the cause of the German hyperinflation of 1922-23? A woman lighting the stove with Marx is the picture. So the hyperinflation started about the time that the government stepped out of the policy making by law of the private bank, private central bank, up through November of 1923.
So inflation starts when somebody starts printing too much money.
Far too much.
Yeah.
Inflation, it's hyperinflation when it's far too much. It's just inflation if it's too much.
Yeah.
Okay. Ian, the next one.
How is a currency destroyed? The hyperinflation. And in the chart, we see that in July 1922, there were 300 marks?
Mm-hmm.
Dollars won.
To $1.
To $1. 300 marks to $1. November 1922, 9,000 marks to a dollar. January 1923, 49,000 to a dollar. By July 1923, 1.1 million to a dollar. And by November that year, 2.5 trillion to a dollar.
All in one year. Yeah.
Well, all in like six
one
months.
One and a half years.
Yeah. One and a half. Okay.
Yeah, one and a half years.
The private Reichsbank printing presses had been unable to keep up, and other private parties were given the authority to issue money. Schacht estimated that about half the money in circulation was private money from other than Reichsbank sources, and that's Stephen Zarlinga.
Yeah, they couldn't
keep up with it.
I mean, at a certain point, don't you just stop and say, that's it? My God, look at this man.
The government didn't have any control.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Who didn't have control?
The government.
No. They were not in charge.
Nope. Look at that big bowl in front of that man on the lower left.
Tiny man and a great big bowl.
Oh, my God. Ay, ay, ay. We'll do the next one.
This is 7, is the cause of inflation. Schacht tells the truth. Jamar Schacht, the magic of money, translated from German by Paul Erskine. And at Old Bond Book Company, Lavender and Locker. Okay, Schacht, the magic of money, page 65 through 66. Schacht's first explanation was to blame the actions of the private bank on the government, assuming making new issues available for government expenditures. Because the point at issue was the survival of the Reichsbank did not regard itself justified in refusing, even after the passing in 1922 of the law which gave it formal autonomy. Okay, what's this
going to
lead to?
So at this point, Schacht is still defending the bankers.
Yeah.
You say?
Yeah. They couldn't help her.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Martin, do the next one.
Okay, again, the science of money. And we have a weird cartoon.
A clown.
Sort of clown-like figure. But anyway.
The magic of private money, right.
I guess that's the cat out of the bag, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
He's alive.
Yeah. But he proceeded to let the cat out of the bag. The private Reichsbank had made lavish loans to speculators, selling the mark short and driving down its value to nothing. In previous years, such speculation had been carried on either with loans which the Reichsbank granted lavishly or with emergency money, which one prints, were printed for oneself and then exchanged for Reichsmarks. The loans formerly easily obtained from the Reichsbank were no longer granted. So there we go. Speculators were shorting against the mark with money from the private central bank, the Reichsbank.
Yeah, lavishly. This is Schack talking, lavishly.
So the speculators were really trying to destroy Germany.
With the help of the bankers.
Yeah.
So who was behind it all? Who were these people? God. How did this, you know, the poor people of the country. My God.
So, are the bankers planning to pay back loans?
Right, so they would, the speculator would need margin. You know, he didn't have all the money to buy the foreign currencies, so he'd take a loan out from the Reichsbank, and he'd buy the foreign currency, right, with all these marks that had been made out of thin air.
The banker printed.
And the more that the speculators bought with these marks, bought foreign currency, the less value the marks had, because there were just more and more of them being created. And so the currency trader could turn around, take his dollars that he had bought, and buy more marks, pay back the loan to the bank, and still have a profit, and then go back and do it again, get another loan, and lavishly. That's what Schack said, lavishly. And that's why you could get trillions of dollars of these currency. So I'll do the next one. Schack tells the truth. Currency speculation on a large scale should not be legitimate. This is Stephen talking. The speculator is creating marks by selling short, selling what he does not have. This drives the value of the currency down. The speculator can then buy it back cheaper, pay back his margin loan, and pocket the profit, and start all over again. And this is from Stephen's book, page 581. This kind of currency speculation is at the expense of the producers and working people whose lives and enterprises are dependent on that currency. Currency speculation in such large amounts should be viewed as a form of aggression, no less harmful than dropping bombs on the country in question. I'm sure it caused many deaths and hungry people, and upset people and distraught people. You know. They don't know. These people don't have any feelings. They don't have feelings.
So here we are, all back to the selling short problem.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That's very interesting, yes. They'll do it in the currency market, they'll do it in the stock market, they probably do it in the derivatives market, they do it probably all over. And do the next one.
Thus, it was a privately owned and privately controlled central bank that made loans to private speculators, enabling them to speculate against the nation's currency. And that's Stephen. And there we have a Reichsbank note of 20,000 Schwanzig Taulant mark.
February, I think that's February.
1923.
Yeah. During the hyperinflation.
Right.
$20,000
mark. Or, I mean,
20,000
Reichmark.
Reichmark.
Mark.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, in color, too.
Yeah.
We'll do the next one.
More stabilizing the monetary situation. Reichsmarks, okay. Rentenmark. Oh,
ah,
yeah.
This is different.
Yeah, it's the Rentenmark currency. We have one, and it says find Rentenmark. So I don't know. It's a Rentenmark cup. So this is a new currency.
Yes. Rentenmark.
October 23rd.
Okay, yeah, October 23rd.
November.
It says
October.
Then it says early in November 1923.
And this is where Shock comes in and starts to.
To recover the currency.
Yeah, to do something about the hyperinflation. He was hired by the government to do it. This was solved by the government. Do the next one, Will.
Okay. November 1923, Sean became the government's commissioner of the currency, a new position created to stabilize the currency. The government now actively exercised monetary control. November the 15th, 1923, Shaw put in circulation a new currency, the Rentenmark. By not over-issuing this currency, Shaw hoped to contract the legal currency and establish confidence in it. The Rentenmark was not legal tender. It could not be used for international payments or transferred to foreigners. This crushed the currency speculation. Okay, it was not fixed in value to the fall of Reichsmark. Fourth, had its value set arbitrarily at 1 = 4.2 trillion Rentenmarks. $1.
$1 US, yeah. But this could not be used in international transactions.
Yeah.
You couldn't use it to buy foreign currency.
Yeah. Hopefully the public would slowly gain confidence in the new currency.
It's kind of a pretty one. Look at that. Is that corn?
Wheat.
Yeah, it's wheat. Yeah, it shows labor.
No, it is corn.
Is it corn?
Well, anyway.
We're city girls.
We don't know.
Could be rye.
Rye.
It's symbolizing the productivity of the people.
Yeah. But my question is, why didn't they make it legal tender?
Don't know. Maybe they didn't want it used to pay back old debts.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's probably it.
Yeah.
Because the idea was to eventually stabilize the Reichsmark.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Martin, do the next one.
Okay, this is Schacht in charge. The German government stabilizes the currency. And this is Schacht from The Magic of Money, published in 1967 on page 68. The invention of the Rentenmark did not stabilize the mark. The battle for stabilization continued for a year, passing through many a difficult phase. And over here on the left, we again have Schacht, The Magic of Money, page 668. It says, issue number one, the private issuers of emergency money. I'm quoting, while before the war, the presses of the Reichsbank had printed all banknotes, in 1923, 133 additional printing firms were needed to supply the demand.
God.
The Reichsbank often had to ask the provinces, municipalities, and individual large concerns to print money and put it into circulation, their own emergency money. By the end of 1923, there was as much emergency money as Reichsbank money. The result of issuing these emergency notes was that the Reichsbank lost control over the circulation of money and also stopped presiding over the credit system. Right. right, we have November 17th, 1923, a decree.
Now, this is coming from Schock as head of the, what's he called, something of the currency, the commissioner of the currency.
Okay, so this is from Schock, okay? A decree. The Reichsbank would not accept any emergency money after November the 22nd. Holders of emergency notes had 4 days to receive them from safe deposits in the Reichsbank. And that's that.
Yep. He doesn't quibble. 4 days. And he was given the power to do this. And he got a lot of flack, but he persevered. And it happened. Ann, do the next one.
Schacht in charge. The government stabilizes the currency. Now, who does he remind you of?
Hitler. You got that mustache.
And it's Elmar Schacht.
So,
look at that collar.
Yes.
Look at that collar.
Funny. December 1923. Schacht made president of the Reichsbank, issued to currency speculators again. December 1923, trade was accepting Rentenmarks and Reichsmarks on equal terms. December 1923 to April 1924, Reichsbank granted credits to business, went from 609 million to 2 billion. Commodity prices were up and Reichsbank's foreign reserves were down. Speculators began to hoard foreign exchange. They were getting Rentenmark loans from German banks to buy foreign currencies, and these banks were ignoring the law forbidding loans of Rentenmarks to buy foreign exchange.
The actual banks were saying, oh no, we're going to do this. Can you imagine what Jalma felt?
Yeah.
I'll do the next one. March through May 1924, Schacht crushes currency speculation. Schacht and the Reichsbank, now he's president of the Reichsbank at this point, right? Crushes the currency speculating. At first, Schacht used reminders and exhortations, but these did not stop the banks making these speculative loans. The Reichsbank then took drastic measures. One, these banks were denied use of the Reichsbank's clearing facilities. So you can imagine a large bank has to clear through the central bank. It has all these transactions and checks and everything. So suddenly they're saying, forget it. You know, your transactions are going nowhere in the banking system. Number two, the Reichsbank refused to discount their bills of exchange until they comply. And this is how a bank gets loans from their central bank. So forget about getting a loan from your central bank. You're isolated. So April through May of 1924, the Reichsbank decreed that there would be no credit. It suspended all new discounting of bills of exchange to the entire banking system. And this is one of the basic reasons to have a central bank, and Schacht said no. No more credit, period. Speculators, therefore, were forced to exchange the dollars they had bought with loans, to go back and buy Reichsmarks to pay for their dollars, but the foreign exchange, their dollars flowed into the Reichsbank. They lost a lot of money. The wholesale price index from April to June went down from 124 to 115. The credit restriction was working. So he said, not again. And they kept him there. He had a lot of flack from businessmen who couldn't get credit and from the banks who couldn't get it. Will, do the next one.
Schacht in charge. The government stabilizes currency. December 1924, Schacht converts Rentenmarks into Reichsmarks. The currency contraction was brutal. Overdraft charges rose from 40% to 80%. By the end of 1924, merchants and others treating the rent mark and old rent marks as equal. Schaff converted the rent marks into price marks by the end of 1924.
Right.
And you have that picture of it. He lived till 1970.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the 19th century to the middle of the late.
He spanned a long time.
Yes, he was. And he was a banker the whole time.
Yeah.
Long life.
Martin, do the next one.
Yalma, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yalma.
Who was attacked? Why did the banker Schaff give the details of the true cause of inflation 40 years later? Yalma Horace Greeley Schaff. Schaff was born in Tingleth, Schleswig-Holstein, Prussia, German Empire, now in Denmark, to William Leonard Ludwig Maximilian Schaff and Baroness Constance Justin Sophie von Eggers, a native of Denmark. His parents, who had spent years in the United States, originally decided on the name Horace Greeley Schaff in honor of the American journalist Horace Greeley. His father returned to Germany as a newspaper editor.
Yeah.
However, they yielded to the insistence of Schaff's family grandmother, who firmly believed the child's given name should be given. Schaff studied medicine, philology, and political science before earning a doctorate in philosophy in 1899. His thesis was on mercantilism, demonstrating how they were aware of the quantity aspect of money from the 1500s and the 1600s.
So I guess when he was studying philosophy, he was learning about money. Because he did his thesis on mercantilism, which is, we would consider that economics today, you know. But he was, really, his family was a good part Danish. His mother's side was Danish. And his father wanted to call him Horace Greeley Schaff. Yeah. So, you can read a lot about him. We'll talk about him some more next class. His relationship with Hitler, and he was tried at Nuremberg, and he was acquitted, mostly because he, in 1938, he had a conflict with Hitler. Hitler wanted to keep creating money and start using it for armaments, and Schaff really felt like you don't use money, which he was to him sacred, a sacred trust in the nation, you don't use it to build weapons. Mm-hmm. And he sent a note to Hitler saying, as head of the Reichsbank, note to Hitler saying, no, we will not give you any more credit. And Hitler fired him, so. Stephen said that probably saved his life at Nuremberg. So there was a part of him that had some feelings about fairness. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why he let this cat out of the bag, you know. Oh, skip the next one. That's go to the next one. This, I should have deleted that slide.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, we're on 11.
Yeah. And
the Dawes Plan. The 1924 Dawes Plan, forged in Paris by a group of economic experts under the chairmanship of American banker Charles G. Dawes, had proven a giant step toward German stability. It provided a loan of $200 million to the German government for industrial recovery. It also alleviated the awful burden of Germany's reparations payments to Allied nations. Although the total amount was not reduced, it was made payable in 2.5 billion mark annual installments over an indefinite period of time. And that's from Stevens Arlinga. Germany's 1923 hyperinflation, a private affair, the Barnes Review, etc. Now, the Dawes Plan relied on capital lent to Germany by a consortium of American investment banks led by the J.P. Morgan and Company under supervision by the U.S. State Department. The German railways, the National Bank, and many industries were mortgaged as securities for the loans. So here we have a chart, USA, France, and Germany. USA gives Germany, lends money to Germany, which is spent on building up the German economy. And Germany uses increased tax revenues to pay reparations to France. And France pays back war loans to the USA and imports US goods to help rebuild France. Sue is on the phone, tracking down her eyeglasses.
Thank you.
At another place.
They didn't find them.
Oh, okay.
I'm wearing these eyeglasses. I have a piece of tape on one of the lenses to keep it in place so I can at least see the slides, you know?
I think we can see it now that we know it.
Did you do this slide? So, you know, I just found this very interesting that here the U.S. is going to loan the money so they can get paid. Yeah, what is it? Money solves everything? Is that it? Money out of thin air? And of course, it all came from, you know, the international banks, Morgan, and I'm sure a whole consortium of American Wall Street banks, you know. So you can fund the war, and then you can fund after the war. And you're just making interest the whole time. The whole time. Oh my God. Awful. Just horrible. Just horrible.
Payments made hella forever.
Yes.
Period.
And that's a good part of what I wanted to communicate at the Left Forum is that these debts are just, they just increase, you never get out from under them, and the money is constantly filtering up to the banking system. What a system.
And you never get out of debt because there isn't enough money in circulation to pay the debt off.
Forever.
Right, there's only 3% real money. That's the government's coins and notes. That's it. Everything else is credit that disappears when you pay off the loan. It's just an incredible system. I don't know. Okay, Will, you do the next one.
Okay. Foreign loans used carefully. This is from Zarlinga, page 589 of the Lost Science of Money. After the Dawes Plan loan to the Reichsbank came through in 1924, foreign credits began to pour in. Champ was against the loans and insisted that any foreign borrowings only be to finance production, not luxury or consumption. This policy from 1924 to 1929 resulted in Germany establishing Europe's most modern factory system of the period. They were investing it in productive resources. Okay. In 1930, Champ resigned from the presidency of Price Banks in protest over some allies' economic ruins. In 1933, Champ was reappointed to the Banks presidency when the National Socialists came to power. This appointment reassured Germany's big business and foreign bankers.
And that's the symbol of the National Socialist Party.
There.
And that's the end of part one.